Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Leslie Sponsel. He's professor emeritus in the Department of Anthropology at UH Manoa in Hawaii. And today we're going to talk about his latest book, Yanomami in the Amazon, Toward a More Ethical Anthropology Beyond Othering. So, Dr. Sponsel, welcome to the show. It's a huge pleasure to have you on.
Oh, it's a great pleasure for me, and I am deeply appreciative of your interest in the Yanomami.
No, yes, of course. In fact, I've had other conversations with people on the show about them and other traditional societies as well. So, but tell us first then, who are really the Yanomami? I mean, what kind of society are we talking about here?
Okay, well, the Yanomami straddle the border between Venezuela and Brazil in the Amazon, and estimates are up to 40,000 for the population, and the villages may be about 400 villages. They range in size from a few dozen people to several hundred. Although in the latter case, it's usually associated with missionary bases that have attracted the Yanomami for medical care, for schooling, and for trade goods. The Yanomami are basically a subsistence economy of hunting, gathering, fishing, and Swidden horticulture. Although really the emphasis is on the hunting if to capture quality protein. They live in villages that traditionally they're round houses and there are no walls, sometimes even no walls on the outside. And certainly no walls separating family units or members of the family. So their society is really characterized by intense intimacy, both socially and ecologically. They're into the forest almost daily for foraging and farming. And one of the remarkable things about the Yanomami is that they have been an independent population for about 2,000 years. This is on the basis of genetic, blood group genetics, and also linguistics, two very different kinds of evidence which converge on that same conclusion. And they are the largest indigenous society in the Amazon. They are radically different from Western cultures that we might be familiar with. And one of the big differences is that they do not distinguish between the natural and the supernatural. Their forest is permeated by spiritual forces and spiritual beings. And another major difference is that reciprocity is really a pivotal elemental value of their society, moral and ethical value of their society. We might see some aspects of reciprocity as negative, but many are positive, including things like cooperation in food sharing, in labor, the use of resources, and so forth. So there are in many ways radically different than Western cultures. And I think that is one of the attractions. Incidentally, if you search on Google Images for Yanomami, there are a multitude of images, and they're very photogenic people, including their body ornamentation with feathers and with pigment paint. So that's basically who the Yanomami are, but they're a complex, rich culture, very diverse, and it's difficult to really characterize them in a nutshell.
I understand. And why was it that at least some anthropologists were so drawn to studying this society specifically?
Yes. Well, there are two cases and a more general statement. And one is Napoleon Chagnon, who focused in on their aggression and characterized them as a primitive savage society with chronic endemic warfare that was basically ubiquitous, although later he recognized that there was some variation among villages and regions. And so one journalist in the U.S. News and World Report in 1988, William Elman, titled his article, A Laboratory of Human Conflict, A Laboratory of Human Conflict. So this is one of the major reasons. The Yanomami have been viewed by many as evolutionary survivals, some kind of time warp from prehistory. And that is part of the echo chamber of the Hobbesian mindset that sees warfare as natural, inevitable, innate, ubiquitous, and so forth for our species. The other reason is that the Yanomami really represent in many ways a fundamental expression of human nature. Their society appears to be relatively simple, though if, for example, you try to make a bow and arrow and use it and go hunting successfully, it simply is not so easy and simple. Right. There are many areas of complexity in their culture, including their language. And so human nature and also primitive and violence are among the attractions. And if I may read one short quote from a book by Kenneth Good, his Into the Heart, 1991, he spent about a dozen years living and studying with the Yanomami, American anthropologist. And he states on page 13, to my great surprise, I had found among them a way of life that, while dangerous and harsh, was also filled with camaraderie, compassion, and a thousand daily lessons in communal harmony, unquote. So he really spent so much time with the Yanomami because he was attracted to their culture, a genuine culture, not a spurious one, to use Edward Sapir's two terms, genuine and spurious culture. This is from an essay he did in 1924. A genuine culture in the sense that people feel a meaningful, significant relationship with other people and their lifestyle. And so Good really was attracted to that culture personally, emotionally, as well as to do the research that he focused on, which was animal protein capture.
Right. And now, when exactly? Yeah, go ahead.
Let me just say then a more general reason for the attraction of the Yanomami is the mystique of the primitive. The term primitive went out of style in anthropology, maybe you could say became politically incorrect in the 1960s, recognized as pejorative, ethnocentric, and possibly even racist. Although Napoleon Chagnon, as late as 2013 in his memoir, Noble Savages, uses the term primitive and savage repeatedly, and check in the index. But at any rate, in anthropology, for more than a century and a half, the primitive was really an attraction. And the Yanomami were seen as one of the more primitive societies.
And when exactly did anthropologists start studying the Yanomami?
Well, anthropologists professionally trained in the 1950s, but explorers, naturalists like Alexander von Humboldt in 1800 contacted Yanomami and wrote about them. So Catholic missionary, a Salesian Catholic missionary, Luis Coco, in Venezuela, lived with them and wrote a book based on 14 years of his experience with them, which, in my opinion, is the most comprehensive ethnography or description of the culture. And 55 pages in one chapter devoted to Western studies of the Yanomami. He catalogs these. In my own book, I think it's in Appendix 5, I have a list of all of these, as many as I could find. And it's surprising to many. We think of Chagnon, Ken Good, and a few others as students of the Yanomami, but actually, they've been studied by more than, I would say, by now, 100 anthropologists. Quite remarkable. And the literature is in 8 languages and in more countries. And so the literature is vast. But most people in the US are only familiar with Chagnon's work, possibly also Ken Good. In France, Jacques Lissot, who was a student of Claude Lévi-Strauss, a very famous anthropologist, and a few others. Lissot also in Venezuela is well known. So it was in the 1950s that missionaries started, and they did some anthropology as well. And then it was in the 1960s that Chagnon, Lissot, and others, fully trained anthropologists, began to study the Yanomami.
You've already talked a little bit about this, but what are some of the most common stereotypes people have about the Yanomami?
Well, there are many generalizations, characterizations, stereotypes, some derogatory, some even dangerous. And among them are that the Yanomami are primitive, savages, isolated, uniform, engaged in chronic endemic warfare, fierce, male-dominated society, and basically ignorant illiterates. And to varying degrees, different anthropologists have mentioned some of these, but Chagnon, I think, more than others. And to just take 3 examples, ignorant, illiterate, savages. Well, by now, and for maybe a couple of decades or more, there are Yanomami who are trained as teachers in their schools. There are Yanomami who are trained in simplified tropical medicine and give inoculations and use microscopes to identify the type of malaria they might have in their blood, and so on. There are Yanomami who use laptop computers and the internet and email and so forth. It's quite amazing. There are Yanomami who have traveled outside the Amazon to port towns, and in particular, Avi Okpanagua is a Brazilian Yanomami, the most prominent among their leaders. And he has traveled internationally and even spoken to the parliament in Britain and to the United Nations and so forth and so on. He co-authored a book in 2013 called, let me get the The Falling Sky, Words of a Yanomami Shaman. He co-authored that with a French anthropologist, Bruce Albert, and it's 600 pages, and it is quite remarkable. It is a sort of autobiographical ethnography or an ethnographic autobiography. And there's a whole chapter on his apprenticeship as a shaman, which is unique. And that book, I think, if there was any book I would point to read on the Yanomami, that's it, because it's written by a Yanomami or researched and with Bruce Albert, the French anthropologist, as well. So the Yanomami, from my point of view, and I had the privilege of living and studying with them in 1974-75 for my dissertation at Cornell University, and I focused on the behavior and ecology of hunting, and I found them not to be primitives or savages or very aggressive, although there were some instances of violence in the village where I was, but people, fellow human beings, not the other, but us, simply a radically different way in terms of lifestyle, culture, and so forth. Let me just add, they are not isolated totally, although they've been an independent population for 2,000 years. Brian Ferguson did extensive library research, their ethnohistory and the ethnographies. And this is in his book on Yanomamu, a political history, Yanomamu warfare, a political history. Very meticulous, very thorough. And he points out that the Yanomami have had intermittent contact, at least on the periphery of their territory, for centuries, 2.5 centuries. And they've had direct contact on the periphery for decades, even before many anthropologists and missionaries started. There were rubber tappers in there and others, loggers and so forth, in some regions of the Yanomami territory. So again, isolation. And the other one is fierce, lastly. I mean, these are just three I'll mention stereotypes. And fierce, Napoleon Chagnon, who's the most prominent anthropologist in America for studying the Yanomami, and deservedly so in many respects, he glosses the word Waitiri as fierce and claims that this is a self-designation of many Yanomami. But a missionary turned anthropologist, linguist Ernst Migliosa, was a missionary for many years with the Yanomami, and he, and also Bruce Albert, who has worked with the Yanomami for decades, off and on, they point out that the term Waitiri has a very broad and diverse range of meanings, and Chagnon only focused on one. And some of those meanings are very positive, like, for example, brave or courageous, having endurance and so forth. Others we might see as more negative, being aggressive, personality, etc. And also I point out that in terms of fierce, are children fierce? They're about half the population. Are women fierce? Half of the population is males, half females. Are elderly people fierce? Are all men fierce? Some do not go on raids. Some do not engage in any kind of aggression, etc. So characterizing Yanomami population as a whole as fierce is very problematic.
Right. I think you've ended up already answering what would be my next question. I was about to ask you about the reality of their life ways, but what are the aspects of human nature that they are usually associated with and people think would be universal?
Well, I think the dominant mindset in Western culture is Hobbesian, that humans or human nature is basically violent, competitive, territorial, etc., etc. This goes way back. But in quotes, modern times, Robert Artrey, his book, The African Genesis, The Territorial Imperative, The Hunting Hypothesis, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into detail, but that mindset has dominated very often. And what is missed is the flip side, the other side of human nature. We have a capacity for cooperation, for empathy, for compassion, for loving kindness, and so forth. And in fact, there's been something of a paradigm shift. Brian Hare and Vanessa, I forget her last name at the moment, husband and wife team anthropologist at Duke University, wrote a book called Survival of the Friendliest.
Mm-hmm.
Survival of the Friendliest. And if you haven't interviewed him, you should.
I have interviewed Dr. Hare about that book. So.
Great. And others have gotten interested in this perspective as well. So we're beginning to have a more holistic, a broader view of human nature, and that we have the capacity to go in either direction, killing or non-killing, violence or war or nonviolence and peace. And this is a very significant turn, and it could have profound implications, particularly if it eventually this new way of thinking reaches political leaders who are the ones that make wars, not the ones who do the wars, who fight in the, like in Ukraine, but the ones behind the scenes that, for the most part, that make the decision to send an army into war.
So you've already addressed some misconceptions people have about the Yanomami, including them supposedly being war-prone and very violent. But why is it that at a certain point they sort of became representatives of humanity at large when it comes to things like violence?
Well, I think a lot of it is through Chagnon's writings. And he got on the bandwagon, so to speak, of sociobiology, now more often referred to as evolutionary psychology. And I would not personally deny that there is some validity and utility in those approaches, mm-hmm. if they do not go to the extreme of becoming fanatical,
right.
and simply reject all other approaches, that they alone have the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got on that bandwagon. And of course, I think it was 1970 or so that Edward O. Wilson wrote a monumental, one of several monumental books, Sociobiology.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last chapter of that, he dealt with humans. And that was very popular, but also very controversial. And E.O. Wilson is also not simply a famous biologist, entomologist. I would say the Darwin of our times, but a public intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
And like Steven Pinker and others, and you could think of several public intellectuals, they have an influence. They get on bestseller lists like Steven Pinker and E.O. Wilson and so forth. And Chagnon then rode that wave, I would say, with the case of the Yanomami. And think his work is very important, but also in some ways can be very dangerous, and actually has proven to be so in Brazil, which we may talk about later or whenever you wish. I would quote from Survival International in London, their website, a statement by no less than 19 anthropologists. And quote, "We, the undersigned, have all worked with the Yanomami Indians for prolonged periods of different times during the last five decades. We've closely witnessed them as a generally peaceful people who, as many traditional people do, occasionally engage in intervillage conflicts, ritualized raids, and duels. Yet the casualties of these culturally controlled conflicts are extremely low if compared with those of the violence and contamination inflicted on the Yanomami by gold miners and cattle ranchers who invade their lands." We absolutely disagree with Napoleon Chagnon's public characterization of the Yanomami as a fierce people, violent and archaic. We also deplore how Chagnon's work has been used throughout the years and could still be used by governments to deny the Yanomami their land and cultural rights, unquote. This was in February 26, 2013. It's on Survival International's website. If you search 19 anthropologists who have also worked with the Yanomami, some many years longer than Chagnon, like Bruce Aubert and Kenneth Good. So, and yet, the defenders of Chagnon, the allies, the sociobiologists, evolutionary psychologists like John Dubey, like Raymond Haynes and others, ignore this statement and ignore other criticisms. And some would wonder, is this really objective science and scholarship when you only look at one side?
We've been talking a bit about Napoleon Chagnon, but what do you think are really the limitations of the work he's done on the Yanomami, particularly when it comes to things like aggression and war?
Well, one of them is, what about the other half of the population, namely women? He talks about reproductive fitness of males, and that adult males who kill more people have more wives and more children, and therefore greater reproductive fitness. But he does not talk about the reproductive fitness of women, mate choice, and other things, as if women were robots, simply productive and reproductive automatons, that they have no agency in the politics of the society and in aggression, warfare, etc. And so it's really a one-sided view. And Alcida Ramos, who is a Brazilian anthropologist that has worked extensively with the Yanomami in both basic and applied research and advocacy for human rights, she mentions that from her point of view, her experience with the Yanomami, they're not a male-dominated society. And Marvin Harris, a quite prominent anthropologist, and others have referred to it as a male supremacist complex, male supremacist complex. This doesn't fit with the views of many other anthropologists like Ramos. So that's one big problem. The other problem, and here I'm a dissenter, if you'll forgive me.
Of course.
And that is, I do not think the Yanomami actually have war. I do not think they have war. And I teach a course on the anthropology of war and peace, and I've looked into the literature, not only by anthropologists, but historians and philosophers and others as well. What is the meaning and significance of war? And in the case of the Yanomami, they, and I want to find, if I may, another quote. This is the last quote I'll take time for. This is from Kenneth Good, from his book, Into the Heart, 1991, and on page 44.
Right.
He states, "The Yanomami I knew never engage in anything like open warfare. They think it's absurd to risk your life that way and possibly get a lot of people killed. Instead, a raiding party will sneak up on an enemy village and hide in the bushes overnight, maybe on the trail leading to the village gardens. Then, next morning, they will wait until someone passes, shoot him, then run off. No heroics, no single combat, no mass battles, just hide, shoot, and run. You accomplish your purpose, and you don't get yourself killed in the process," unquote. Again, Ken Good lived with the Yanomami for about a dozen years. And also Lee So, he has a chapter in a book I co-edited in 1994, Anthropology of Peace and Nonviolence, about the ceremonial dialogue that Yanomami males engage in as a form of peace process, peacemaking, ceremonial dialogue. And he also mentions in that chapter that the Yanomami do not have any word for war or peace. They do have a word for shooting arrows, but that's something else. So Ken Good, who's much more of an authority on the Yanomami than I, my knowledge of the Yanomami, I was with them, but it's based mostly on following the literature as closely as I've been able to, given other interests and obligations. Since I worked with them in 74, 75, the literature is enormous. And again, in eight languages and some more countries. And I just don't think they have warfare. And again, I'm a dissenter in this case because others who, like Brian Ferguson, titled his book, Yanomami Warfare. But Ken Good says, no, no open combat, etc.
By the way, I'm also interviewing Dr. Brian Ferguson next month. So
that's great. That's great. He's very, he is the anthropologist for the study of war.
Yes, for sure. So I would also like to ask you about another anthropologist whose work you also focus on in the book, Patrick Tierney. So did he study exactly?
Patrick Tierney is actually not an anthropologist. I think he had some anthropology courses, perhaps, but he's an investigative journalist.
Okay.
And in the year 2000, he published a book called Darkness in El Dorado. And that book ignited scandalous controversy worldwide. In that book, he alleged that Chagnon and some of his collaborators at certain times in the field violated professional ethics and human rights. And he had a multitude of diverse allegations to that effect. Almost every page in the book has some other problem that he found. His book really caught the attention worldwide of anthropologists and the public. and embarrassed the AAA, the American Anthropological Association. They were forced by pressure, by this controversy, to appoint a special task force, which investigated for over a year the whole controversy, Tierney's main, most serious allegations, and spent something like $25,000 in the investigation. Some members of the task force even went to Brazil and Venezuela and interviewed Yanomami, among others. And anyway, eventually, they came out with a final report in which they made a number of statements about problems of ethical conduct and maybe violations of human rights, like not getting adequate informed consent or research, like promising that the research taking blood samples, etc., would eventually help the Yanomami in terms of health, which they task force said really were not honored, and so forth and so on. Some of Chagnon's work was published in magazines and newspapers in the U.S. and then picked up in Brazil. And according to Leita Martins, journalist, anthropologist, Brazilian, in a book by Robert Borofsky. And I'll mention the, I want to get the title right. Yanomamu, The Fierce Controversy and What We Can Learn From It. This was in 2005. And in that book, there are a series of three roundtable discussions and debates among anthropologists on either side of the controversy, pro-Chagnon, critical Chagnon. And Leita Martins was in Brazil and among the Yanomami and so forth at various times. And she mentions that the Brazilian press picked this up and that the government and the military used the fierce image of the Yanomami and other characterizations by Chagnon to, in various ways, against the Yanomami and their land rights and other human rights. And I won't go into detail, but I do in my book, because we're limited in time. Eventually, after the final report of the task force was published on the AAA website, there was an article in the American Anthropologist, the major journal of American anthropology, by Thomas Greger and Daniel Gross, two Amazonian specialists. And that article, I think it was around 2005, that article argued that the task force's inquiry was very problematic and marshaled argument and so forth, which I also talk about in my book in one of the chapters at great length. And I find their argument not convincing at all and very problematic in many ways. But the AAA bought their argument, and eventually there was a referendum for the membership, which was drafted by Chagnon's defenders. And that was voted on by the membership, but only a small percentage of the membership actually voted. Those who did vote, the majority were in favor of the referendum. After that, the AAA purged their website of the final report and other information about the controversy. You can find that information, however, on Douglas Hume, H-U-M-E, his Darkness in El Dorado archive, which is fairly neutral for the most part. and has all sides of the controversy and reprints articles by people, famous anthropologists like Marshall Solins and Clifford Geertz, who talked about the controversy in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others, and so forth. And the AAA's final report is there, also its preliminary report. That archive is a gold mine. It's a treasure, a resource for historians, for anthropologists and others, political scientists, anyone concerned with looking deeply into the controversy. And so in other ways, there is the Borofsky book, which I mentioned, which was something of a miracle, because he managed to get six anthropologists who disagreed on either side of the controversy to actually discuss and debate and in three roundtables. And then he couched that with a substantial introduction and conclusion, and it's framed for students. And that is probably the single best book on the controversy. And I would suggest you might want to consider having Robert Borofsky on your interview sometime. He has pioneered something called public anthropology and has a website on that. And then in 2010, a famous Brazilian filmmaker, José Padilla, made a documentary film called Secrets of the Tribe about the controversy with the principals in it, Chagnon, Ken Good, and others. And that was for the BBC in London. And then it was also later for HBO in the US, home box office in the US. Mm-hmm. That was viewed by millions and millions of people. And it's available on YouTube. Several versions have been posted over the years. And it is important because Chagnon makes his point of view clear, as he did later, 2013, in his memoir, Noble Savages, which is a very important historical book because it's his point of view on all of this and the Yanomami, the controversy of Yanomami. So there is, despite the purging of the controversy from the AAA website, which I think is unethical, personally, my opinion, and that of some others, they're supposed to be transparent and accountability and so forth and so on. Look at the code of ethics of the AAA. And I think many people would conclude that censorship is really problematic and anti-science and anti-academia. And so even though they purged, there's a record out there in public in various venues, not going away. And even in recent times, some European anthropologists a year ago or so published journal articles on the controversy. And there are a couple of books that also deal with the controversy. It's important historically. Let me just quickly see if I can. Well, I don't have them handy. One is called Scandals and Scoundrels by Ron Robin. And the other one is Controversies in Anthropology by, I think it's Gavin Weston and another editor. And that was 2020. So this has not gone away. And I have waited and waited and waited for some objective historian of science or objective anthropologist or whatever to give a fair view, overview and critical analysis of the controversy. No one had done so. So in 2014, I started writing my book. And I cannot claim to be completely unbiased, like any human, but I have tried to be as objective and fair as possible. And I cite the literature. The book is grounded in the literature, the bibliography is over 1,400 citations. And I didn't cover everything by any means. This is quicksand.
Yeah, I imagine. And talking about the biases, I would like to ask you in this last part of the interview about that exactly. So, and of course, we've been talking and focusing on the Yanomami just because they are the topic of your book, but I would imagine that this would apply to many other traditional societies that have been studied by anthropologists. Do you think that we should have sort of a, let's say, anthropology of anthropologists, in the sense of should we study what motivates anthropologists and also the biases that drive their fieldwork and research?
Yes, indeed, I certainly do. And in fact, Robert Borofsky authored a book called An Anthropology of Anthropology. It is time to shift the paradigm. And this was published fairly recently. In 2019. Mm-hmm. And if you look at his website, that book and other things are discussed, and I think they're available open access. And so he's looked at this. And again, I would say one bias in terms of studying the Yanomami is, again, the Hobbesian mindset. Mm-hmm. They are exemplars of a tribal warfare, etc. Also, another bias is that the mystique of the primitive, which maybe the word isn't used much anymore by most anthropologists, but the idea is still there. And I would say instead, they represent a manifestation of human nature at its most fundamental. And again, they're sustainable. They have survived for 2,000 years. And the mm-hmm. forest is still there, wherever it hasn't been invaded by aliens like illegal gold miners.
Right.
So there are biases in anthropology, and this is one thing, confirmation bias, implicit bias, and many other kinds of biases that scientists and academics need to be aware of and scrutinize in their own work, as well as the work of others. And this happens, for example, in part through peer review of journal articles and book manuscripts and so on.
Mm-hmm. So one last question then, particularly about the Yanomami, but again, it can apply to other studied societies. What do you think these looking at how people studied the Yanomami and their life ways? What do you think are the questions surrounding the ethics of anthropology and fieldwork and also human rights that are raised there?
To take the AAA, the American Anthropological Association, it was founded in 1902. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until the 1960s that they really began to formalize guidelines for ethical conduct. And that has been an ongoing process, and it's been largely reactive rather than proactive. In other words, when some scandal or controversy erupted, and particularly if it became public in the media, then the matter of ethics was again addressed. And Carolyn Flohr Lobon has written and edited books on ethics and anthropology. And since the Darkness in El Dorado controversy erupted, there's been a lot more interest in a number of other books, which is one positive outcome of that controversy, even though it was very ugly and there were many negative things as well. But there's been increased interest in professional ethics, that beginning in the 1960s, and it's still going on. And the AAA has made a number of revisions of its declaration on ethics. You can find those on its website and some of the history. Then in the 1990s, there was a turn, a shift of interest within the AAA to consider human rights and advocacy anthropology as a form of applied anthropology. And in the 1990s, there was a commission for human rights and then a subsequent committee for human rights. And I was one of the founding members and the first chair of both. And I had the privilege of working with eight other anthropologists and others outside as consultants, including lawyers, on human rights issues. And that was one of the most inspiring experiences in my whole career. These were knowledgeable, dedicated people, advocates for human rights. They were reputable scientists who had done basic research and continued to do so, but also did applied research. And Mark Goodale, Goodale, A-L-E, has edited and written books now, very recent years, on anthropology and human rights. And the AAA website, you can find a declaration on anthropology and human rights. It first came out of our committee for human rights and in 1999. And then in 2020, that was revised and expanded, and it's available if you just search for human rights on the AAA website. And, you know, with ethics, the bottom line is do no harm, mm-hmm. which goes way back to the Hippocratic Oath,
yes,
and beyond. But there are many anthropologists who also feel that's not enough. You have to try to do no harm, but you also have to do good. And one way to do good is in this field of advocacy anthropology. And there are a number of NGOs, international NGOs, established by anthropologists. Survival International has worked most closely with the Yanomami, but there's also Cultural Survival, established by David Mayberry Lewis, a professor at Harvard University, who had worked in Brazil with indigenous peoples. And he did a series of films around 2000 called Millennium, and a book, companion book. And that Millennium aired on PBS in the US and beyond in the world. And it was basically advocating the value of cultural diversity and knowing and understanding that diversity. And bottom line, really recognizing that the so-called other is really us. We're all humans. We're just different in various ways, including culturally, linguistically, and so forth, as well as in terms of our politics, our sexual orientation, and so forth and so on. And so one of the virtues of anthropology is really celebrating this diversity and trying to publicize and get people to understand and appreciate and respect it. And that in our world today, obviously, that's really important. And the Yanomami need to be recognized as fellow humans, simply an alternative way of relating people to each other, to nature, and the supernatural. A radically different way, but another way, and fellow humans. And incidentally, one of the things, lastly, I forgot to mention is that a number of people who have done research with the Yanomami, three or four of them have independently observed in their publications that the Yanomami laugh a lot. They're happy people in general. And so you might actually call them the comedians or the humorists or the jokers, but any single word or phrase wouldn't do justice to such a complex, rich, diverse culture as the Yanomami. But laughter is something that has independently really impressed a number of different investigators, and it's in the literature. I cite it in my book.
Right. So, Dr. Sponsel, I just wanted to say before we go that I also wanted to have you on the show, not only because of the book, which was great and I recommend to everyone, but also because of my previous conversations with Dr. Douglas Frye. We talked about war and peace systems and all of that. And I think it's very important to have these conversations on my show and elsewhere, of course, because unfortunately, even though, of course, the work by people like Napoleon Chagnon and others is useful and to some extent partly true, but it doesn't represent the whole picture. There are people out there who unfortunately in recent years, decades, have written popular science books which present only this one-sided view, which I think is extremely unfortunate and disappointing because it paints a very bad and limited view of traditional societies, and also I think intentionally or not might feed racist and supremacist views and politics.
Yes.
I will be leaving a link to your book in the description box of the interview, and it is again Yanomami in the Amazon, Toward the More Ethical Anthropology Beyond Othering. Just before we go, apart from the book, would you like to mention any places on the internet where people can find your work?
Well, beyond the Yanomami, my main interest since about 2000 has been spiritual ecology. And I have a book in 2012 on spiritual ecology subtitled A Quiet Revolution. And I also have a website, spiritualecology.info. And so people can also find about my work there. I have broad, diverse interests. I'm not a narrow specialist. That's somewhat of a limitation also.
Okay, great. So, Dr. Sponsel, again, it was a big pleasure, huge pleasure to have you on the show. And thank you so much for taking the time.
Yes, thank you for your interest in the Yanomami. Thank you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing and to keep the channel sustainable, please consider supporting me on Patreon or PayPal. All of the links are in the description box of this interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check the website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett, Perga Larson, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Ian Riccalania, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Wo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger, Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Narcio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernardini, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cusson, Ivan Bodrenko, Paul Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Haslam Bullitt, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T., Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W. João Oeira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Deja de Araújo, Romain Roach, Dermito Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavlo Stasevski, Nella Kbak, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Afzal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edwin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litske, Dennis Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Todd Shackelford, Sunny Smith and John Wiseman, my producers Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Tafiniak, Luis Caetano, Tom Wagner, Dan Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardis Francis, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder, and my executive producers Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.